Hello and welcome to episode 46 of the Wilder podcast. In this episode, we speak with Jo Roberts, CEO of the Wilderness Foundation and a woman whose life and work have been shaped by wild places. We explore how wilderness heals, teaches and reconnects us, and why access to nature might just be one of the most important public health rights of our time. Good evening, Tom.
Hello. Yeah, no, that's a good episode to look forward to. That's just chat. Got me quite interested. Connected some nerve endings in my brain with a few ideas. So, you know, something to look forward to. Chloe, should we do a little introduction as to who we are, just in case there's anyone new listening to the podcast? We are Chloe and Tom, husband and wife. We are the founders of the Grange Project, which is an 80-acre nature restoration project in Wales, in Monmouthshire. And this podcast has kind of got two main roles, one of which is about documenting our journey as we go from complete and utter amateurs and lacking in knowledge or expertise around nature restoration, or even fully understanding the impacts of climate change and biodiversity loss and all the other challenges that are facing this modern society that we're in today. And the second facet is basically interviewing some fantastic people. Each episode, we get a privilege of picking the brains of some of the best and the brightest, most interesting people within the space that we are exploring now. And we learn so much from it. And hopefully you as a listener will as well. Is that okay, Chloe?
That's perfect, Tom.
Oh.
Nailed it.
And what we normally do is have a little update as to the work we've done on the project most recently. Then we get into the interview. And at the end, we have a bit of a reflection on the chat and the kind of things that we've learned and we want to take away from it. So Chloe, any updates from today? This week? No, month, whatever. How long it's been since the last episode?
There's been lots going on. I feel that as we're in this changing season, it feels like a natural point of reflection. And one of the things I've been thinking about is just the many hand hours that our amazing volunteers have contributed over the summer, and how I think as the project's developed, we've welcomed more and more people to the site and more people that have come to stay for longer periods, and how their energy and their ideas and their wisdom have helped to shape the project to what it is today.
Definitely. It's been one of the biggest surprises for me, I think, doing this project. We always knew we were going to do community days, but we hoped and thought, and I think we still do believe, that we're going to give back to those people that come to this site, and we want to energize them when they come. But what's ended up happening is, hopefully we've done that as well, but they've kind of, the inverse has happened. These people have come and brought their energy, and that's energized us. But not only energized us, we naively or massively underestimated how much work and effort that was going to be required to get the Grange Project up and together. And quite frankly, we wouldn't have had enough hours in a day for you and I, Chloe, to do all of the work that needs to be done in terms of the maintenance of the project, in terms of the nature restoration interventions, but also, most crucially, I would argue probably at the moment, is the market garden as well. So through necessity, we've opened it up to members of the Wilder podcast community, but also woofers. And for anyone who doesn't know what a woofer is, Chloe, what is a woofer?
I just had to Google it actually to double check, but it's Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms is what it stands for. But it's an amazing platform.
Which is willing workers on organic farms. Has it changed?
Has AI let me down? I don't know. No, I think it is worldwide.
Okay, fine.
But they're also normally very willing. So let's go with that. Yeah, it's this amazing platform which essentially connects hosts. We are now a woofing host, and people that are interested in having experiences across the globe around learning how to grow food and other related tasks that occur as part of farming. And we've had some really interesting individuals come and contribute in lots of different ways. And we've left with everything from new ideas on how to stick up tomatoes, sourdough starters, wisdom around how we nurture baby plants. Like, it's just been fantastic. The knowledge sharing has been so valuable.
And just to reiterate before we move on is, thank you so much to anyone that's come and volunteered your time. It's changing the face of this project, and only for the better. Over half of this project wouldn't be in the state that it was in now if we didn't get people coming willing to support us. So I hope that we look after people very well when they come, and we hope to see them back at some point, you know, regular visitors.
For me, it's over the conversations we have over the kitchen table, and some of the ideas and insights that are shared in those moments have also helped shape our thinking and the general direction of the project in ways that's sort of hard to pin down.
Definitely.
So if you might be interested in coming and volunteering from next season, which will be about March time next year, then get in touch and we'd love to have you.
hello@grangeproject.co.uk, and it will be in the show notes. So enough about that. The only thing that's important really in this episode, apart from, of course, the interview, is the new arrivals.
We have been blessed with two additions who are already causing havoc on the project.
So we've got Pigs version 2. So our friendly Pigman Paul has kindly offered to lend us his two Berkshire pigs, two sows, and they arrived and wow, they're workhorses.
They're little machines.
They just don't stop and their rootling is fantastic. And keep listening. I won't go into the benefits of them. I've done it enough times on the podcast already, but I'm sure I'll reiterate that later on another episode.
I do want to just add a little thing today, which I noticed because it brought me so much joy. I was sitting out looking out the kitchen window and I saw the two pigs arrive there, you know, doing their thing, rootling. And then suddenly a little robin appears going straight after them. And not only were the pigs doing amazing benefits to the soil and opening up opportunities for new plants, but they were also providing a food source for the robin. So it was like win-win.
And they are hugely distracting. I mean, I sat at my desk now at the office and I can see they do loops around the project and they don't just like, you know, waddle around like imagine pigs to do. These pigs are, they're speedy pigs.
They go at a canter.
When they get to a point where it's downhill, they're like little children. They want to run. And so they just run down the hill and they're having the best time and they're living their best life. So yes, they're massive ecological benefits, but the land just feels right with pigs on.
When they're not trying to escape from it.
No, they did escape. But it's okay. I've now reinforced the defences. The minefield is in place with the automatic gun turrets ready to go. So it's all good. Won't happen again, hopefully. Right, Chloe, would you like to introduce the guest, the topic, and a bit about what she does before we get into the chat?
It was our absolute delight to welcome Jo Roberts onto the podcast. She's the CEO of the Wilderness Foundation, which is an amazing charity, which essentially kind of uses the power of nature and wilderness to transform vulnerable lives, whether that's young people or people that have been through adversity. And they deliver that through nature therapy programs, wilderness trails, outdoor education. And there's something there about that reciprocal benefit of the people experiencing the power of wilder nature and then working to conserve the wilderness that is then accessible to them.
And I'll say that this came at a really good time for me because I'd just come back from a bushcraft experience. So I was glowing with that, the power of being out in wilder nature. So yeah, hopefully that will come across as well.
Good morning, Jo, and welcome to the Wilder Podcast.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so delighted. Whenever anyone mentions well-being, nature, and also in kind of connection with rewilding, your name and that of the Wilderness Foundation comes up. So it's so exciting to have this conversation to be able to kind of privilege some of these topics.
Well, I must admit, you know, when you work really hard at building up a charity from source, when you hear a statement like that, Chloe, it feels very reassuring that the message is getting out there. So thank you for saying that.
Well, it absolutely is. And perhaps on that note, before we start the conversation, maybe it'd be really helpful to know a little bit about kind of your story, Jo, and how you've ended up in this position of CEO of the Wilderness Foundation.
I think, Chloe, often life has a funny way of curving round and you don't realise it steps until you're right in it or near the end. I think I had a very lucky childhood being a white South African and a father who was deeply committed to wilderness and wild space. And he didn't do it in a fancy way. You know, he'd take us on an old folding chair with the mohair blanket and sleep out in the wild. And, you know, so I think I learned it from a very simple, basic format. But he was passionate about birds and he had that extraordinary ability to tie the systemic side of nature together. You know, so that was a story for every creature because it hung on something else's story. So I was very lucky with that, and I think that grew my love of nature. But it's only as a therapist and later in life have I really reflected on my own childhood experiences. And actually, I don't talk about it much, but I had a very traumatic childhood in many ways. And lots of things happened, but, you know, I probably tick a lot of the ACEs boxes that we talk about so much today. And I think nature was my salvation. Nature was where I would play in the garden behind the bushes and make imaginary houses and imaginary families. And I think for me, it's been that sort of deep connection from a belonging, a sense of awe and wonder that sort of seemed to fill empty spaces. But I never thought, I mean, I tell everybody, oh, I had this magical childhood. It was so fantastic. And it was in that wilderness nature setting, but it wasn't in that social setting. I had wonderful parents who were curious and wanted to do things, but they were very involved in their own stuff. So it was a particularly lonely childhood. You know, it's the My dad was in some ways a bit of an activist. My mother was a social worker, but suffering from extreme depression her whole life. And it was a strange world because, you know, you grew up in the heart of Johannesburg with immense privilege, although we were never a wealthy family, but a big garden and space, and we could get out into nature really, really quickly. But you were also sitting in a very complex political space with enormous contradictions. So it's complicated, but also grew up with a very strong ecological and social conscience. And regardless of the past, you know, we do try and make lemonade from lemons some of the time. I'm really grateful because I think if I just had a little boat that sailed on flat water, I probably wouldn't do the work I'm doing now.
Yeah, so I guess that's a really lovely reframe there, Doe, to talk about how those experiences, yeah, in some ways built the foundations that have enabled you to do the work that you've done, even those at times that must have been really challenging. And I can only imagine being part of that social and political context and how that would, yeah, influence your kind of sense of stability and security in that sense, and the sort of seeing the essentially the trauma that was surrounding you. But the resource of nature in that is really powerful. I suppose I'm curious about what then led you to move to the UK and become connected to the foundation.
I fell in love with someone who was English, who was out in South Africa, you know, before apartheid ended. And I met Paul, and I think he represented a lot of stability and safety. He was very traveled, very interesting. We fell in love in South Africa, and then he was due to come back to the UK because his post was finished in South Africa. And he said, well, you know, why don't you just come and see? And at that stage, I was working as an anthropologist for the mining industry, which I was having huge battles with them anyway, because I'd felt that the life of the migrant worker wasn't actually looked after well enough from a systemic point of view, with children and families left at home for 11 months of a year, and had some real sort of battles. And so coming to England in the middle of apartheid and with that level of frustration seemed the right thing to do. And then I never went back. But it was a nice ability to come and try it out. And I honestly don't know why I stayed, because it was winter. I got chicken pox within about 2 weeks of traveling on the tube. I was cold. I had to lie on the floor in Paul's flat in Putney because it was old underfloor heating and the windows were frozen on the inside. So I think there must have been something more enduring. It certainly wasn't an easy passage into life in living in the Northern Hemisphere.
And when did you join? Was it straight away that you started work with the Ornas Foundation, or were there meanders in that?
Lots of meanders. I think I got a temp. Well, I was an anthropologist. That was my training and my first real love of academia. I'd worked at Cape Town University and then Johannesburg Mining and then came over. But I think we then, what did we do? I worked as a temp and then I started, you know, doing more social programs and work. But then read Ian Player's book, who was the founder of our movement. The Wilderness Leadership School was our first organization in South Africa. And Ian had written a book called Shadow and Soul. He was a very sort of avid Jungian. And I read his book. And then I also read an article that started to talk about a project called Imbewu, which means seed in Zulu. And that was a project taking inner city kids back into the wild, reconnecting them with an ecological heritage that race had divided and lack of opportunity had created. And that was the huge turning point for me. And so went into an overdrive almost to start to raise funds to support that program and take more young Black South Africans back towards their cultural heritage, which was run by elders from communities, many who'd been game rangers all their lives, didn't speak English. Some of them had never really had literacy, but had a deep, deep understanding of the language of nature. And having them share that with inner city kids who had never seen anything other than the streets of Soweto or inner cities within South Africa, and regain that, felt like an enormous mission, because it sort of put back my own privilege, but also my own probable understanding of deprivation on an emotional level. So it was very powerful.
I suppose when we talk about wilderness, you can really picture within a kind of African savanna what wilderness looks like. But when I think about wilderness in the UK, I perhaps struggle more to get a sense of what that is and what that looks like. And I don't know if you could speak to that a little bit. And also, what are the psychological differences between being part of nature in terms of a green park or a garden and that true sense of wilderness, as I think we're describing, as you're describing there?
Endures, you know, it's one of those really big ones. But there is through wilderness in wild spaces, you know, of Africa, where you've got vistas and spaces that feel that they haven't been changed by humankind. However, there was an article just recently on a story on Radio 4 where they were doing mapping, and they basically were saying that nearly all of the earth, bar most of the ocean, has been adapted by humans. So I think we kind of live in a bit of an illusion sometimes about this sort of untrammeled landscape. But I think it's landscapes for me that have been left to be self-functioning as much as possible. Landscape where nature's own intrinsic ability to turn itself round and upside down and pop back up is kind of allowed to be. But even within wildernesses or so-called wildernesses, there's management. You look at the vast national parks of South Africa, they fenced, they managed, there's overpopulation of species. There is a kind of constant underneath management. But I think on the whole, it is that sense of we're not determining how things work. Nature's determining itself. That for me is my greatest sort of sense of wilderness. I think North American wilderness probably is, you know, the John Muir landscapes and the Thoreaus of the world. That is vast tracts of wild wilderness, you know, vast tracts. And I've never experienced that sort of pristine kind of quiet coldness of deep forests like you do in North America. But I love the rawness of African wilderness. I love the fact that human beings are a tiny, tiny little blip in a very, very big space. And I think that kind of can be found across Europe. Some of the big forests that we've worked in on the Ukraine border, in Slovakia, Czech Republic, there's still those senses of where there's a sense of I need to be thinking about where I am. There are big animals here. That kind of humbles your human spirit. It gives you a sense of humility, I think. But in the UK, you know, I remember writing to a colleague and saying, oh, I'm looking at this beautiful wild space and it's so quiet. And, you know, I get a sense of real wildness here. And they wrote back saying, that's a load of rubbish, because basically that whole landscape's been eroded by sheep and it would have been covered in forest. And what you're looking at is an incredibly artificial landscape of grassland, devoid of most life. So I think sometimes for me, wilderness is silence and not hearing human noise. That for me can be very wilderness-based. And it's a sense where you're alone. There's an aloneness in wilderness, even though you're part of a big ecosystem, but there are not a lot of people. You're very in a smaller community of humans in a larger community of nature. It's a hard one sometimes to pinpoint.
No, I think it is a difficult one. And I was reading a post recently where someone was talking about how to them there's something about wilderness representing both scale, which I think you kind of alluded to, this idea of being very small in a large landscape, but also having the diversity of nature to bring richness to that scale. And perhaps maybe in the UK, we struggle to find both of those in one place. And again, maybe returning to that idea of the psychological benefits of that. In your experience, what do you think are, you talked about the kind of silence and perhaps that creates an opportunity for a different sort of being that you can achieve in a park or in a garden. But I wonder if you could speak to that a bit.
I often think about our DNA and I think, you know, the whole biophilic story. And I think that I did kind of try and presume I could write something about attachment in nature. And I think we have lost our attachment. There's been a detachment that has actually caused a psychic shock in a way in humanity. I think, you know, often I'll talk about if you stretch your arm out and you take a pencil and you draw a thin line on the top of your shoulder, that represents our current space within evolution. And that's a very busy world. And if you think in the last 200 years, what's shifted and changed for us as humans, and even now the fast tracking with AI and the way that we're living is losing eons of time of where we lived actually in an intact relationship with the natural world. And I think this detachment is causing an illness within our psyche. And I think that it's because we're not connected, we're not belonging, we're not rooted. And we think that we can function alone, that we don't need each other. And we absolutely do. I think that our DNA makes us a social animal. We need to be together for safety. We designed, we bonobos, just by 5% DNA missing. And I think we've gone into concrete walls, into very linear ways of living. I think we've lost collective experience of families a lot of the time. I think we've lost a deep sense of our own wildness our own sense of need to be connected to the world. And I think it's making us ill. I think the trouble is, like you, Chloe, as well, you know, we work with people who are really, really struggling to be, who are really suffering in this world, you know, mentally. And a lot of the time, there can be people who just don't know how to be with others and be comfortable and safe with others. But actually take them into wilderness and you just watch a kind of farming ability to suddenly start to feel again, because the panic of not being safe can drift away. Depends if you've got lions prowling around your camp. But I was actually in supervision yesterday about this with Roger Duncan, who supervises me, and we were talking about this kind of almost through the wild experience, you can reconnect to yourself. So it kind of brings you back into your own body, into who you are. And we've had young people who've almost needed to go through a wilding experience to find themselves again, because they've just completely lost all sense of themselves, the other, and the space around them. There's so much science as well on the brain. On, you know, you can spout out loads of stuff on fractal patterns and awe and wonder. And I love soaking it all up and reading it, and the statistics of forest bathing on cortisol levels. I mean, there's so much science. But actually, it's kind of, sometimes it's just being in the wild that can soothe and give you back something of value.
Yeah, I mean, I recently went on a bushcraft course for the first time. The thing that struck me the most, apart from learning how to skin, butcher, cook, all that kind of stuff, this stuff you just don't do, was that when you're walking around the camp, and there's about 15 people there, everyone had a job to do. Everyone was busy and everyone was contributing to the greater good. And it felt right. It felt nice. It felt nice to know that everything was being productive in a way that was in line with nature, in line with supporting each other. And we were getting around the campfire. You know, never met these people before, but suddenly people are opening up, telling us about their story, their background, why they're there. And it was brilliant and really inspiring to spend the time there. But I do hear what you're saying about the danger element, and I do think that's an important bit of adventure, probably. If, you know, again, we don't get that much danger in the UK, but adventure maybe is the best we can get in the UK, because Chloe and I were very privileged as well to get out to Africa and have a go on a safari. There's nothing quite as adrenaline pumping when I woke up and could hear the munch munch of a hippo outside the tent, you know, less than a couple of meters away, knowing how dangerous an animal the hippos are, let alone the lions and everything else that's there. But hippos are, and the only thing we had next to me was an air horn, which I wasn't overly convinced by either. And I was terrified at this point. I look at Chloe and she's like, just go back to sleep, Tom. I'm like, go back to sleep. There's a hippo next to us. But coming back to the UK and that difference between danger, I mean, have you found a surrogate or another way of creating that effect of that's maybe missing from the UK landscape when you're doing your, I mean, would you call them events, interventions? What would you call them?
I think they're more interventions than events. I think they've got a really deep purpose into them. You know, there's really well thought through processes. But yes, I think for me, sea kayaking became the next best adrenaline moving. I needed to work really, really carefully with nature. I needed to kind of, I could feel a clenching of my stomach muscles. I needed to be really careful here. I needed to really listen, watch, learn, because I wasn't particularly safe if I didn't do that. And it was, nature was much stronger than me. And I needed to be alert to taking really good care. And we did an amazing sea kayaking journey around the Menorcan Biosphere Reserve with a group of our turnaround young people who are highly complex, and sleeping wild on beaches and then kayaking through the day. And it was unbelievably powerful experience, because sometimes you had young people who didn't appreciate the danger of not performing in a certain way. And then I've done other quite long sea kayaking journeys where I'm nervous. And I think it's because I had a near drowning experience in a sea kayak, which I think was quite traumatic for me. And so now when I am sea kayaking, I've got that in the back of my head about capsizing. So I'm more conscious now than I was before, and I was probably a bit gung-ho before. Now I really understand what can go wrong if I'm not cautious and careful and well protected. And I was alone. You know, I was pretty stupid when I did have an incident. So now I'm always with other people. I'd only see kayak with people who really can guide well, can deal with an emergency. Before, I would be much more thinking I was invincible, and I don't think that anymore. You know, one thing to say is that some young people, I'm saying this cautiously to protect somebody, would talk about a mountain and we would think it's a small hill. And their life experience is so different to ours that their perspective of what is big and dangerous is something we would take for granted. But for them, it is a mountain. And in fact, that so-called hill stroke mountain was transformative for a young person because they came back into their body in that experience, which they'd avoided for years and years and years. You know, it talked about cliff edges, which was a gentle slope dropping for about 6 or 7 feet. But for them, that was their reality. That was what was a major threshold of conquering their own internal fear and mechanism and coming into themselves. So it's very interesting, you know, this idea, going back to what Chloe was saying about wilderness. Some people can feel wild enough in a backyard filled with nettles. They can find some kind of soaking into a space that's kind of messy and wild and unstructured and doing its thing. And, you know, you mentioned something about the parks versus wilder spaces. I think parks are becoming much wilder now, but they can still feel like a little blip and a little pimple of wildness. But they're very important. For urban communities, it gives space to run and to play, but they feel manicured to me. I was very disappointed because I really like to find evidence that backs up that, you know, the wilder the place, the better our mental health. And I went to a talk where the research didn't say that. They were actually saying that parks and walks in parks could offer the same mental health benefits as being in wild nature. And I'm still trying really hard not to believe that because I still want to fight for nature to have its own power. But for some people, that walk in the park is the same for another person to walk in a big, big wild landscape. So it's different.
I wonder there, Joe, it was making me think about that definition of wilderness and it feels like there's kind of two parts to it. There's something about the kind of, you know, innate benefits of being in a natural space. And I have to say intuitively, I would agree with you that it feels to me like the more diverse and rich the landscape. And I think there are mechanisms of change you could make sense in that in terms of, I mean, obviously things like the fractal patterns, but also the kind of microbial health that's around you and how that interacts with your...
Yeah.
Anyway, let's not go down that rabbit hole. But I was also thinking about what opportunities the wilderness creates. So you were talking about, I think Tom, you were saying about that kind of sense of shared purpose, everyone having a role, the slight sense of kind of being on the edge of yourself, the kind of danger, the silence, the embodiment of being. And I think those, how you create the conditions where nature provides those opportunities, and whether that's in a slightly wild area of a park or whether that's in a, you know, vast North American forest, it's perhaps about how you create those opportunities within the space of wilderness.
I think, you know, some research we were doing with Essex University many years ago focused on facilitation. So for people who've not been into a wilder place, actually the facilitation is really, really important because you're almost role modeling how to be within that wild space. So how to be respectful, how to manage, leave no trace, how you interact with nature. You know, we think leave no trace is critical, not just from nature, but for our own respect for self, others and nature. But when you look at wilderness therapy, and, you know, often when we've been looking at this in depth, teaching it, there's adventure therapy and there's wilderness therapy and there's ecotherapy and there's all these different things. I think the pure form of wilderness therapy, going back to its sort of early days, is you are a small group that go away into a wilder space. You have to learn how to cohabit. You have to learn what Tom was talking about, where we're all contributing to the whole. So it's almost within that wild place you're re-socializing. So that's an enormous part of it. You're also needing each other because you can feel that this is that DNA of our little bonobos coming out. We need to be together to feel safer. If I'm in a tent all alone at the fringe of the camp and I can hear noises in the dark, I'm going to be far more terrified than if I'm in a tent with another person. You know, they're all these kind of socializing, needing each other. But also, I think it teaches an ability to cope with challenge. It teaches resilience. You know, if you have to walk to the river to fetch your water and carry it up, if you've had to get through deep homesickness, but you're far away, how do I draw and learn what I'm capable of? in that world, because you can't just switch on a tap. You can't just jump in a car. You can't do these quick solutions that we have in our everyday life to escape things or to quickly find things. We have to slow ourselves down, and that can be not going home straight away. That can be having to value your resources. You know, if you walk to the river and you come back to camp and someone doesn't see the water bag and they kick it over, that's a big deal. You've got to go all the way back down to the river and come back with the water again. Or you didn't remember to sterilize and you've walked away 2 hours or an hour till the water tablets work. Or everything sort of slows down to value, and then the value of each other. And I think sitting at night, either around a fire in the open, or sitting in a tent with driving rain with a group of young people and doing what we call our rosy glow. What did I see in you today that was really special? And just watching people's faces just shine with a sense of, actually, I'm okay. I've got goodness in me. Other people have seen goodness in me. Mm. It's just so precious. And somehow you can't do that in a boardroom. Somehow you can't do it in a kind of everyday world. It's almost, we need to be taken away to almost kind of get it back. But I've also seen it happen in a park where we've sat under a tree and talked and connected and fiddled with the grass with our fingers. But there's levels of intensifying it that I think we get high intensity on a wilderness trail, medium intensity, and then lower intensities. But they're all valid.
There's so much you said there that I completely agree with. I mean, from my side, the thing I wanted to pick up was, well, two things. Firstly, modern day society, if you don't agree with something or you don't want to be involved, you can take yourself away and be quite happy distracting yourself with social media by yourself to avoid the need to be part of the tribe. I'm not sure that's great for long-term mental health. And secondly, again, reflecting from my time in the bushcraft course, everyone had a role, so that, you know, and it was different skill sets. So some people were really good at whittling. So everyone sat down and they were doing the whittling, was providing something worthwhile for the group. So maybe you didn't want to talk, but you could sit around the fire and you could do your whistling. Or someone was really good at weaving, creating the cords for the camp, for the ropes, etc. Or cooking or foraging, whatever it might have been. Everyone had a role, and you could find the thing you were good at and you're particularly interested at and belong. But again, contributing to this greater good, this camp, this tribe that you found yourself belonging to. And I'll say it one last time. What you're doing sounds wonderful. It sounds like I want to go on your courses because I truly believe in it. And I came away so inspired from my little taste of spending time in nature as well.
I love the phrase you used there, Joe, about slowing down to value. That's one I'm going to hold on to. I was thinking about how also the use of ritual to punctuate those moments and the importance of that as a space for people to come together. And again, if we're able to slow down, we're able to privilege rituals that promote connection with each other and wilderness. I wonder whether you could sort of talk to us a bit about some of the programs that are offered by the Wilderness Foundation and how you provide these opportunities for these wilderness experiences for those that need them most.
We run a lot of day programs as well as the wilderness expeditions. So our day programs are probably the most that we do. In fact, I'm starting another cycle on Tuesday, which I'm so excited about, is our Blossom program, which is for survivors of domestic violence. And we run an all-women's program, a teenager program, and a children's program, heavily oversubscribed. Unfortunately, I think domestic violence was said to go up by 40% during COVID. And I think as the economic pressures are biting in, it's going to come up again because it's a kind of a dysregulation under stress often that drives violence. So we work on a day program. So women are with us from 10 until 2. It's a very ritualistic program. It's very much around soothing. And in fact, the team of us therapists who run these programs, we talk about the nurture element. We're very Maslow in our work. It's how we frame what we do. We soothe. There's a lot of soothing when people first come, deeply anxious, very, very, very frightened of the world, frightened of themselves, frightened of others. And so we bake and we make tea and we sit by the fire and we have blankets and we say to women, you sit, we're cooking lunch, we're making you a cup of tea, you're here to be held by us. And then within that space, they talk, they find a connection, they don't feel so alone. But then we do a lot of art therapy, we do a lot of creative work, We do a lot of being led very much by where our group is at, boundary work, a lot of rediscovery of the self. You know, I think domestic violence takes away any sense of who am I, because that's been kind of either coerced or pounded out of you. I am not okay as who I am because it's obviously not accepted. And the same works the children's work. We work in a slightly different way. It's, again, about play, about regulation, about responsibility, about the who am I. We put a lot of work into values. We take a lot of work in rebuilding that sense of I'm actually okay. It's not my fault that this has happened. Other people have been dysregulated. I'm making it sound very trite. It's actually very complex, and there's a lot to say about it. Then we run another project called Brave Futures, which, again, we've started doing a lot of men's work, running all male groups. And we're just looking to start a men's drop-in, particularly for younger men at risk of any suicidal ideations or deep sense of depression or anxiety where it feels uncool to go to therapy. So we're thinking about starting evening drop-ins now, which you could sort of book on Eventbrite, but run by male therapists, and you can pop in and be by the fire. And we'll have some theming to that, but just to kind of de-stigmatize therapy. And then we've got programs for young people who are excluded from school. We've got significant behavioral issues, which I think is all systemic stuff anyway. And I think either people go inwards or they go outwards. And we deal with both. We deal with the outwards and the inwards. I call them the innies and the outies. And then, you know, we've got our turnaround program, which we started in 2007 and has driven quite significant research around wilderness therapy over the years with Essex University. You know, there's a 10-year study on our work, which was published in 2019, and we're now just rekindling and re-going through the latest evidence of our work. And Turnaround is two big wilderness journeys. Turnaround has weekly mentoring for young people. It's got workshops. It's got social evenings. So we've tried to create a kind of a really family systems-based piece of work there to wrap around the young people, working in family mediation with them as well. And really over a long period of time, engaging with a very small number of people, actually, but a very big program. And our research showed that there was no recidivism within 3 years of coming on the program when we were working with a lot of young people who were already with youth offending and others. Now we're working with more innies, you know, young people who've switched themselves out of the world, who game by night and sleep by day, who don't know how to reconnect with the world. And we're working a lot more with that kind of young person at the moment. And then we work a lot with SEND. So the foundation has around 7,000 beneficiaries this year, 6.5 to 7 as we're judging it now. And included in that is a lot of special education needs and disabilities. And that, as we know from recent articles and statistics, the diagnostics of anxiety and depression is through the roof as a disability. And it's almost more and more people are withdrawing because of it into isolation. So those programs run with bushcraft. We do a lot of cooking. We cook on the fire every day for all those programs. We do a lot of bushcraft work because of trauma. There's a lot of, you know, whittling, you know, regular movement, lots of hammock time. If you had to come and join one of our groups as somebody who's never seen the meaning of the work, you'd think, what on earth are they doing? It looks like everyone's just having a blast. Actually, what we're doing, every single thing has purpose. A bit like what Tom was saying about the bushcraft camp. Every single activity has purpose, from the way we hold the group when they arrive, to the way we soothe them, to the way we play, to the way we then get into more focused work, to then while we cook, how we clean up, how we end, how we say goodbye, how we transition. Everything has thoughtful purpose.
And where do these programs take place, Jo?
So we've tried spreading ourselves across the UK and struggled with that at the moment, but they're mainly in Essex. We now cross into Suffolk with young beneficiaries coming in from Suffolk as well. And we touching into Hertfordshire because we work at Hatfield Forest. We were central Essex. We're now on the fringes of Essex. They're now looking to work in East London, Dagenham, Thurrock, that part of. So it's still very southeast. But then we run a fantastic project in Scotland. So we're also a Scottish charity. And we run a project called Truin, which is all wilderness based, therapy based expeditions. And these are young people coming from inner city schools, from areas of deprivation, and they do wilderness trails as well.
And when I think about Essex, wilderness doesn't spring to mind to me as an obvious location to find that sense of space. What sort of kind of natural context are you using to help sort of be your co-therapist effectively for the emu grounds?
So we're based on a 44-acre farm. That was a, you know, an arable farm. When we first got there, it was open grassland, a lot of set aside, and we've planted 12,000 trees on that farm. And so what was grassland is now woodland. And I still have to pinch myself sometimes when I'm walking under trees that are way over my head, which we planted as tiny whips. Our home base has a mixture of open grassland, woodland, and then older established woodland. And we have long distance pathways like the Essex Way coming through and lots of little public footpaths that we can follow in and out of woodland, across open land, along streams. So we make use of everything on our plate there. Nothing's wasted. And then we've also got, we've been so lucky. I still can't believe it, to buy 92 acres of woodland, about 10 minutes drive from where we are, which is semi-natural ancient woodland. And that will be 80% left for its own rewilding. And then we've got 20% where we're working with community groups and our therapy groups. So every day of the week, there's a group there. That will be semi-managed for health and safety. We can't have branches dangling over our sort of fire circles. But the majority of the whip will be left for its own rhythm. But we've got research coming in now for the next 3 to 5 years with Anglia Ruskin University to get baseline studies of that woodland. And then the way that we'll look after it going forward with a very rewilding hat on will be determined by the research. So that's another space. Essex, strangely enough, has got some of the big royal forests. So Hatfield Forest is enormous. I mean, it is managed, but it has some of the most ancient trees in it. And it is ancient hunting grounds. So, you know, we've got these sort of wild spaces. And then the Essex coastline is fascinating because it's the longest coastline in Britain because of the way it meanders in and out through things like the Crouch and the Blackwater. And so you've got this very sort of bleak, I love it, I think it's my African roots, bleak, wild, whistling open space with a lot of migrant birds coming in and out. So Essex is mystifying, Epping Forest, you know, all these sort of, there's a lot of forest. And if you think of a country with about 6% left of its intact forest, we're not doing too badly, strangely enough, in Essex.
There'll be listeners listening to this from all over the UK. Do you have plans to expand this out further? Is that an aspiration for the future?
It is. We've always wanted to expand. You know, I'm not interested in running a £5 million charity. I'm interested in running a 5 million souls who can benefit from the charity. I think we want to reach more people. And that's why, you know, we actually had some help from Cranfield Business Management. And they basically said, you know, you need to fill up Essex first and then you can start to go wider. So we have had projects that we started in Berkshire. We ran a turnaround project in Berkshire for 3 years. We've had other projects in Yorkshire. We've been talking to some of the rewilders around opening projects up in Somerset and various other places. But what we've learned, Tom, is we need 5 things to make a project work. We've got to have the referrals. So you have to have a relationship with referral agencies. We've got to be able to have a public who are hungry for that service. You've got to have transport. And I think when you work in wilder places, people often can't get there, particularly the people who need it most. You've got to have the right staff. You've got to have the staff who live, breathe, and are passionate about this work from their souls out. And you've got to have money and the right place. We hunt a lot for the right place and have just ventured out to starting to work in public woodlands. So we're now working in sort of public woods owned by Colchester City Council and finding our way where the public are, you know, get lots of dogs trying to come and eat the children's sausages. But we've actually found a corner where we can tuck away and it feels extremely wild, although it's a public woodland. But the funding is the big thing. I've so badly wanted to follow up. I've got the wild space. Someone will say to me, you know, we can link you to social care, but there isn't the funding. And it then falls to us to find all the funding for that expansion. And sometimes that's too much. So if we can find partnerships where we can put all those ingredients together rather than it all falling on us, that then makes it work. But I think also we've started doing a lot more self-funded work. We've stopped trying to be completely, we've got to do it all for everybody. We've started to become a little bit more, we've got this project, we'll run it at cost, but there is a cost to it. And then we also run the free programs for those who simply can't do that. So it's a funny one. I think as a charity, we feel that we should be there to offer everything for free. But I think we've got to find other mechanisms to make ourselves self-sufficient. And we also have to find mechanisms where we can reach more people. And doing it all ourselves doesn't work.
That was really speaking to me there, Jo, when you were talking about that need to reach more people, because I'm hearing that a lot of your programs are rightly so targeted at some of our most vulnerable people that are struggling in society. But I was thinking about how, you know, that feels like this access to this wilderness experience feels like almost like a public health right, that we should have these opportunities to gain the benefits from that connection to nature. And I wonder if you had any thoughts about how we would be able to increase at a universal level our general relationship to wilderness and the therapeutic potential of that.
Yeah, without being political, I think the problem lies within education. And if we, you know, I think there are two sides to this argument. I think that, you know, South African law actually has rights to nature as embedded in its law. It's a human right within as a South African context, which is interesting. But I think we stripped outdoor education out of all the education budgets, which I think, you know, when the crisis comes, environment drops to the bottom. And it really infuriates me, not that I'm an angry person, but there's the one thing that gets my goat is we have lost the absolute wisdom that without environment being healthy and safe, we're nothing. You know, we're toast. But actually, when there's an economic crisis, environment drops like a stone to the bottom of the pond. It's happened ever thus. And when there've been economic issues within education, environmental education has dropped to the bottom of the pond. Outdoor centers closed all over the country. I mean, Birmingham City dropped all their outdoor centers. And this was an opportunity for your average child, your child in need, to come and connect with adventure and play in outdoors. There has to be a commitment of government to ensure that the rights of connection to nature are built in. I think another thing that really I would love to have the time now to campaign is transport. You know, if you're a family growing up in inner city London, to try and access wild space and go out to Hatfield Forest with your family for a picnic and a walk in a bigger, wilder space is very expensive. You can't get there. There was another point that I wanted to make on my daily rant that I can't remember now, Chloe, but it was definitely about how do we get more people out into these places? How do we let people have more experience? I think it's again back to education. If we can teach people. So I'm very excited about a potential piece of work that hasn't been qualified yet, but talking to a university that trains teachers. And we had done this at East London University as well. Big conversation about actually teaching teachers about how to take children into the outdoors in their everyday teaching world. So you could take your children for a walk in Hackney along a pavement. And if you love nature and want to connect your children to nature, you can look at birds, you could look at pigeons, you can look at weeds growing through the pavement, you can look at plants in people's gardens, you can bring all of that into your children if you yourself know how to do it, because you yourself might not have had that opportunity. I think really making outdoor space a place where teachers feel safe that they can deliver work in is a huge piece of spiderability work that we're really interested in doing. And then we've done family work where we've been kind of working with families and then mapping with that family how they can continue the work themselves when they've finished with us. Same with turnaround. We've been trying to sort of not stop at the end of the program, but to create pathways. In Scotland, we looked at volunteering opportunities for our young people to stay connected with conservation organizations post-program. But it needs serious commitment from government, and it needs serious commitment where the importance of this nature experience and nature connection is fundamental. It's not a privilege. It's a basic right. And if we don't learn to fall in love and care for nature, nature has no friends. And nature needs friends in a very human-dominated world. So I would say to everybody, there will be somewhere you can go. There has to be a local park. There might be a river walk. There may be a garden, a botanical garden. There could be somewhere where hopefully without any cost or a little cost, you can go and take time to look and appreciate beauty within nature, because it will be there. But it's almost, that's where the facilitation that came out of our research showed, sometimes you almost need someone to teach you how to do that. Because if you never grew up with a parent saying, oh my God, look how beautiful that sunset is. Oh my goodness, have you seen the patterns in that leaf? Oh my goodness, look at that beautiful stone. Don't you love its colors in it? If the parent hasn't been taught it, they can't teach their child. And you look at Robert McFarlane's work about the lost language of nature. This is where the work is teaching each other how to access and be in love with nature. It has to come from love. And a lot of education is in your head. That's the point I was going to make. It's very intellectual. It's very much a head case work. And actually, through our environmental education work we do that reaches the most of our beneficiaries. It's about living nature, coming into living classrooms and breathing a love and excitement about the natural world. I think that's very important. It's not just the head, it's the heart. And as Tom was doing in his bushcraft, it was the hands. So there was Geddes, the wonderful Scottish architect, who talked about connecting the head, the heart, and the hand. And that's where we need to go. So you look at trauma recovery, the more you can do to fight for something or fight for yourself or take action, the less there was some evidence of trauma lingering. Even if you didn't succeed in fighting, at least you did something. And I think we all have to do something and teach people to do something, whether it's saving a bee or feeding it some nectar when it's been starving or putting water out or creating seed beds for birds. Do something.
I think Chloe and I would completely agree with that. I do think it's important when we come to the education side that the default could be to start talking about the names, the Latin names, the science behind it all, which is important. But there is a huge swathe of people, children, myself included, now and when I was a child, that struggle with that and that side of it. But I think they're the ones that would naturally pick up the physical side of it a lot better, the whittling, the going out, collecting things, feeling that sense of achievement. So if we do, and when we do, when you do, because I've got so much faith in what you can achieve, get that in there. It's about getting the right balance between everything. Now, sadly, we are coming to the end of this conversation. It wasn't the direction I was expecting it to go, but you've had me hooked. You really have, and hugely inspired by what Wilderness Foundation, what you are achieving. I just probably want to highlight here that having ran, you know, teams and projects myself, I know that it's a lot of your kind of drive and determination, but there's no way you could achieve this without an amazingly passionate, capable, professional team behind you. Because the amount of moving parts you've got, I guess that you've got so much faith in your team to be able to deliver all of these. They sound so complete. I just want to pass on my appreciation and thanks for everything that you and your team are achieving and doing.
Well, thank you, Tom. I work with wonderful people. Very lucky.
I so appreciated the space, Joe, for us to be able to really think about that power of the wilderness. And it certainly made me more inspired to kind of go away and think about how do we recommit to this idea of that access, the experience, the opportunities that are provided by these spaces for us being a kind of a public universal right that we need to embed within our education system and all throughout society.
Thank you.
Just before we close out, Joe, what we normally do is come back to our guests and ask, is there anything you feel like you would like to add at the end of this conversation? Or if someone is inspired to learn more about Wilderness Foundation or support you, kind of where can you point them towards?
You can always get in touch with us at the Wilderness Foundation to find out about our programs, our talks, our different kind of well-being events that we run and our other deeper work at our website, which is wildernessfoundation.org.uk. You know, I'm really happy for people to reach out to me. I'm at Joe at the same address, wildernessfoundation.org.uk. And I would just say thank you for giving an opportunity to spread the word, for listening so compassionately to my views and thoughts, which mean a lot to me. But I just urge people to get out, go for a walk, and just take notice of what's around, whether it's the smallest thing like a snail or a red kite flying over your head or the wind in the trees. Each one of those little moments of noticing is enough to get you out of your head and into your heart. And I think that's the best place for us to all be.
Thank you very much.
I think what I've been left with in that conversation is essentially these three key things we need in order to
ensure we help maximizing the benefit of our connection to nature for our well-being. The first thing is we need that natural wilderness. So we need big open spaces, we need diverse landscapes, we need the opportunity to feel like we're in something a bit raw and maybe a bit dangerous in whatever context that creates for each individual. Then we need people alongside us for at least parts of that journey. So that idea of coming back to camp, the contributions, the roles, the people having a sense of shared purpose. But then we also need the sense of something being a bit difficult. So that develops that in, I guess, in psychology, we talk about mastery. So that sense of doing something a bit difficult.
Esprit de corps.
The what?
Esprit de corps.
Say that again.
It's a Latin term, which means, I think it's team spirit, but let me Google it.
Well, while you're Googling it, but yeah, for me, something about building resilience. So then I was thinking, right, if those are the three ingredients that we need, what does that translate to on a kind of practical sense? So obviously we need more nature. We need that to be restored in all sorts of different contexts, whether that's in an urban space that has that sense of wilderness about it, whether that's in rural contexts. And, you know, obviously we have a lot of agriculture, which doesn't really create that feeling of wilderness. So what that translates to. And then obviously the wild spaces of the national parks and areas that are really protected for nature. We then need more connection and community and opportunities for that coming together and the rituals to support that. And then finally, we need those opportunities for challenge. When I think about challenge in a wilderness sense, I think about really tangible outcomes. So I've gone from having, I don't know, no food to having foraged my dinner and cooked it and it's like there in front of me, or I've gone from having nowhere to sleep to having a camp, or I've climbed that mountain, or whatever challenge represents for that individual within that community. So yeah, I was thinking about how do we develop programs or experiences that both model those ingredients and then and provide them for people's well-being.
That's really cool. A feeling of pride and mutual loyalty shared by members of a group.
There we go.
Literally the most descriptive term you were trying to find. You're welcome, Matt.
Well, that was one of my three ingredients, wasn't it? But yeah.
Every day is a learning day.
Thank you.
I'm glad that I can provide value to you.
Mm-hmm. Always.
That's why you keep me around. My reflection is that I probably could have done more poking around the questions and the topic, because the way that she was describing it just sung so true to me that I didn't need to challenge it in my own head. I was like, well, of course this makes sense. I'm completely behind you. Well done. Keep going. I'm so glad people are doing it like you're doing it, and there's people are getting benefits from it. So I feel like maybe I didn't do as good a job as I would have hoped in terms of just picking it and looking a little bit deeper. But doesn't mean that I still don't fully believe in it. And I really believe that anyone would benefit from more time in nature, more time learning things. I mean, even today, you know, it's a rainy day and I and our middle child, William, spent a good amount of time just doing practical jobs outside and achieving things that I just don't really get when I'm sat behind a keyboard and mouse. Even if I do send out a work email or send an invoice or a quote or whatever it might be, it's a different sense of achievement than creating a fence line or digging a hole. I just don't know how to describe it, but it is a fundamental different feeling. Can we research that, please, Chloe?
You could hypothesize it's something around the tangibility of the output, the moving your body and so the physiological benefits of that. And then perhaps, well, obviously there's something about being outside and the fresh air and the sense of space around. I don't know, we could definitely use some research around that.
Yeah, it was good though.
The other thing that really struck me, she was talking about the importance of facilitation. So having people alongside you to help support your learning. And it was making me think about when I was a teenager, I did go off camping with some friends, but I didn't think we really experienced the true sense of wilderness and the opportunities that was provided, because we didn't have anyone to sort of facilitate that connection or encourage us to not just get fish and chips from the local shop and to eat around our campsite. It was making me think about the role of almost like elders in our kind of indigenous sense of having people that have that connection that can help empower us to develop our own relationship with the wilderness in our own context.
I'll challenge you a little bit on that. I think it's neat to say elders, but I think it just has to be role models. I think elders are not necessarily, yeah, I think it's almost a wrong gray-haired person sitting in a tent, right? That's the image that you're, when you're saying this, that's the image that I'm hearing. And I think that is probably not accurate or appropriate. I think it just needs to be role models or someone just inspirational to spend time with those people. And I don't think necessarily, maybe someone who is inspirational wouldn't necessarily see themselves as an elder. I don't know. I think they might, it's an old fashioned term, but maybe I don't think it's that relevant.
No, that's a really good point. And she was talking about this idea of our ecological heritage and how connecting the young South Africans to their sense of place. And I often wonder again, what does that ecological heritage look like for us in the UK? And maybe it's a similar thing, trying to bring constructs from other cultures into our society in a way that doesn't always fit.
Yeah, that's kind of my point. Again, in Africa, makes sense, right? Because that's culturally still there, you know, whether we, you know, they lost it, wobbly a bit, but it's still there culturally. I think it's gone, you know, in this country. And I think we have to maybe word it or find a different way that isn't elders to communicate that value, that person, that guide.
Feels like there's a whole other podcast about the role of Indigenous knowledge and wisdom that we could bring up at some point, but not right now.
Right.
You look less certain.
So, hopefully you've enjoyed this. We always enjoy recording these podcasts. Just to reiterate, if you'd like to find out more about the Grange Project, if you go to grangeproject.co.uk, there's plenty of information there. All the back catalogue of the podcast, a bit more about the project, photos of what we're doing, and lots of ways to get in touch. Chloe, is there anything else you'd like to add before we close out?
No, just a big thank you to Joe, a big thank you to all the volunteers that have supported the project over the summer, and looking forward to welcoming people to our community day at the end of the month.
Let's go.